Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life.
Hello and welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us. Today's guest, we will be speaking with Nicholas Nisley, and he is the Dean of Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Phoenix, Arizona. And he actually was a former physicist, and that led him to becoming a priest. So we're going to find out all about that. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi.
My time, at any rate.
Pardon?
Good afternoon in my time zone, at any rate.
Yes, it is afternoon here in Vancouver as well. Thanks so much for being with us, Dean Nisley. So our editorial director at Namaste Publishing, David Ord, attends your Episcopal Cathedral in Phoenix, Arizona, and he tells me that there aren't many congregations he would feel comfortable in, yet he's very comfortable with your preaching and especially your classes. And so I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about your background, how you went from being a physicist to becoming a priest.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question. It's kind of the other way around. When I was a teenager, I had been very interested in spirituality, and I was, as a child, fascinated with legends and mythology, stories about the cosmos. And I think my astronomical interest, because I really started off as an astronomer, grew out of my kind of looking at the sky and wondering why. Why are we here? Why is the sky the way it is? Where did we come from? All of that. It led me, I guess probably about 10th grade in American high school, to thinking about going into the ministry. And I had talked to a few people about it, and I announced it to my parents, and they were not terribly pleased, but weren't objecting. I think they were hoping I'd grow out of it. And I started getting involved in churches, and I discovered very early on in churches that people are not always very nice inside churches. And it was a relatively lovely congregation that I grew up in, but people were just who they were, and I sort of ran afoul of a couple of big church fights and saw adults acting in ways that I thought people weren't supposed to act in church. And I was too young at the time to really be able to understand why you could still say you were trying to be a good person and act that way. Mm-hmm. And so I decided everyone was a hypocrite and that I wasn't, and so I left. And I sort of ran as far away as I could from religion, and the farthest I could find was in physics. So I spent the next 15 years or so of my life working in physics in particular. I went to college, and I actually dual major in physics and astronomy, and I had a minor in dance. Because I still liked doing theatrical and performance things. Graduated from college with an undergraduate degree, and at that time there wasn't very much you could do with that, so I was able to get a graduate scholarship and went off to graduate school and did my graduate work at the University of Delaware, where I studied. My master's is in quantum mechanics inside black holes, which it sounds really impressive and makes a lot of long equations that no one really cares about. And then my doctoral research is in liquid crystal phase transitions, which actually is related to cosmology in a different way. The question of how ice melts or how steam condenses or how a liquid crystal goes from an isotropic phase to a pneumatic phase is actually related to how the universe began. There was a great deal of research in that back in those days. And a man named Degen, Paul Degen, got the Nobel Prize for it in the mid-90s. So it's the field is pretty much now a mature field, and there's not as much excitement in it, but it's still a wonderful tool. And as I was finishing my doctoral work, I started kind of wondering again about the big questions. And one of the big questions in physics is, what does it mean to look at something? We say in quantum physics that the act of observing a system changes the system, but we don't really know how or why. And I started noodling about that and was trying to understand what it meant to know something, and thought maybe I could learn something from the great philosophers that I could put it down into an equation. And someone suggested I read Plato. And so I read Plato, and I thought, wow, this is really good stuff. I had never read philosophy before. And that got me interested in reading Neoplatonic thought, which is a little more cosmic. And that led me to reading Thomas Aquinas. And one thing led to another, and I started finding myself reading about religion. And then simultaneously, my wife and I had started attending a church one Easter and joined the choir to sing, and got involved in feeding the homeless. And I think it was the act of feeding the homeless and seeing a way to make a real difference in a human being's life that was much more immediate than writing a bunch of equations on a long piece of paper really entranced me. And one thing after another, I found myself back in the church, and all of the urges and all the interest that I'd had as a younger person about becoming an ordained person came back rushing in. And so I kind of walked away from my physics research and went off to Yale Divinity School and did my Master's of Divinity there, and have served now about 20 years as an Episcopal priest in parishes back east mostly, and then the last 5 years here in Phoenix, Arizona.
Hmm.
And I've had a few stints in the middle of that where I've taught physics and astronomy as an adjunct at universities, Lehigh University being the most recent one.
And so, Dean Nisley, I'm curious, when you were in your teens, you noticed all of the hypocrisy happening in the church and how people would show up and not be what you would expect from religious people.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever come to any kind of conclusion about why that is?
Yes, I started looking at myself and realized that I was chief among them. And I think I guess the language you could use, I developed a sense of empathy for them and a sense of, you know, it's really hard to be the kind of people we dream of becoming. At one level, it's the easiest thing in the world. You just do it. But at another level, there's so many distractions and there are so many obstacles in our everyday life that just throw us off our gate spiritually, that we all come in. And, you know, perhaps the person that I was aghast at when I was 17 years old had had a horrible day at work. Perhaps it had been a doctor who had lost 3 patients and was angry at the universe and himself and decided to take it out on the church. And I think as I grew, I learned that, you know, God can take it when we're angry, and the church ought to be able to take it, and maybe I should be able to take it. And I've kind of found my own peace with it now. There's an old sort of saying among clergy that the church is more of a hospital than it is a museum. And I think I finally understood that as I got older.
Beautifully said. Well, I'm curious, with all of the, so many people now are, on the one hand, they're leaving religion behind for science, yet there are so many people who are also coming back to religion as things like the Japan earthquake, all of the earthquakes that have been happening in Haiti and New Zealand and all of this, the tsunamis, everything that's going on, people are starting to feel like, even if they're not religious, they're starting to feel like there's some kind of end of days situation happening. And I'm wondering, as a scientist and a spiritual leader, what's your viewpoint on this situation and our future?
Yeah, if I can quote myself from my sermon on Sunday, and I was actually quoting Dean Beck, who was the dean of the cathedral in Christchurch, New Zealand. And after the earthquake struck New Zealand and his church had been destroyed, he preached, I think, outside the building one Sunday and said to his people, you know, the earthquake that struck this cathedral was not an act of God. It was the fact that New Zealand is on a geological plate that's riding up over the Pacific plate. And the act of this earthquake and the tsunami in Japan is not an act of God. It's the earth doing what the earth does, and the same in Haiti. The act of God is what happens in the aftermath. People beginning to reach out to one another, people caring for one another, people giving of whatever they can to help relief, people opening up storehouses and people sharing, and you know, people plunging through the muck and the mire because they think they hear a child cry in the rubble. And that happened in Haiti. We have a good friend who just got back from 6 weeks working in Haiti at a medical mission site there. We have one of my staff is from Christchurch, New Zealand, has been in touch with his family, and hearing these universal stories of people beginning to recognize, I think because of this response that we have to natural disasters, that there has to be something more to life. That, you know, life is not about getting the most toys or having the most bits in one's digital to analog converter in their MP3 player, or you know, having the shiniest red sports car or whatever it is that we think it is that makes us win in life. That all that can be taken away in a heartbeat. And I think the transience of life that's shown in these kinds of cataclysmic events forces us to start to ask why, how, who, what is the real meaning to this? You know, you hear stories of people working and just going about their everyday business, and two are killed and two survive. Why those two? What's the meaning behind that? There's a great American theologian named Paul Tillich who used to say that most of our sense of God and most of our wondering about God has to do with our own recognition that we have a limit to our lifespan. He called it our liminality. We just have this sense that we are going to die, and it creates a great anxiety in us. And we begin to ask questions about what or why. And sometimes I think people's answers lead them to a sense of this is all there is, a kind of brutal realism that you would find in a scientism. Because most scientists actually don't believe in scientism, don't believe in the kind of brutal reality that this is it and there's nothing more, and it is the nightmarish existence we find ourselves in. People begin to think, no, there must be meaning, there must be an answer, there must be something transcendent. Because it would be too much to bear if this was all it is. And so they begin to ask these questions, and they find their way back. Often I hear people saying, I'm spiritual, but I'm not terribly religious. And I'm never quite sure what they mean by that. I don't know how to unpack it, unless they're like I was so long ago, that they know there's something wonderful beyond this realm of existence, but they can't manage to find a way to be comfortable with the obvious flaws of organized religions and all the various forms and stripes that it takes around the world. But I really do think it's that sense of wondering why and how can this be good and what should I do, and you know, what does my life mean if it can all be taken away so quickly, and how do I want to be remembered? I think that pushes people into one of those two camps. I'm actually finding scientists and people who say they just believe in science now are actually starting to question even that, at least the ones that I'm meeting.
And so, Dean Nisley, in your opinion, if it can be taken away so easily and one house can be completely wiped out and the next one is fine, four people can be walking down the street and two will die and the other two will live to be 100. If there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason and our lives can just end in an instant, what is the meaning of it all?
Well, I think the question is there a meaning first? Mm-hmm. Much less trying to answer the question, okay, if there is a meaning, what is the meaning? I used to talk about looking at the cosmos and having a sense of seeing the palm prints of God the Potter. Every now and then, you just catch a glimpse of them as you look at the grand design of the universe and the way things fit together and the way there is these extraordinary coincidences that make human life and reality possible. And thinking, this is so carefully made, it simply can't be by accident. And that's an act of faith in itself, because there's a pretty strong scientific response to that called the anthropic principle. It says, you know, the fact that the universe exists is why you can ask that question. The fact that you're asking the question and see that it exists doesn't imply that there's a greater design to it. But leaving that aside, the sense of getting a feel of the transcendent in life leads us to begin to think there is some meaning. There's got to be some meaning. And then I think that leads us to the question of, okay, if there is meaning, what is the meaning? And that, I think, is the fundamental question that human beings are struggling to answer in this moment, and especially at moments of catastrophe and crisis. Am I created to suffer? If we believe in a universal being of goodness that has a power beyond our comprehension, why does the universe have these extraordinary hiccups and these shuddering stops so frequently? How can this benevolent deity understand that? And that actually is part of an entire field of Christian theology, and it shows up in Judaism and Islam and other faiths as well, but I'm obviously, as a Christian leader, most familiar with it in Christianity. It was first put forth in a formal way back in the 18th century, and it's kind of a little bit of logic. If God is good and God is all-powerful and all-knowing, then why does God let people suffer? If God doesn't want us to suffer, God could make it so that we don't suffer. And there are sort of three regimes of answers to that if you had about 3 or 4 weeks, we could go into. they're very philosophically powerful and potent and subtle. It's not like people haven't thought about this at length. And in fact, you can go back into sections of the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures, and you can find that authors of books there are struggling with these issues. Habakkuk struggles with these issues. Certainly Daniel and Ezekiel, the prophets, are struggling with this. You see it in the New Testament. You see it in the writings of the early church. Why is this happening, and how can we make sense of it? I think ultimately none of the standard answers are satisfying to me, because I can't look a child who's just lost a parent in the face and say, this is the reason God did this. I find that I end up having to just have a kind of childlike faith of my own that there is a reason for it. And it may be one of those things that I'm, as a finite creature with a beginning and maybe an end, maybe not an end, whatever, I just simply cannot understand. But I can trust that it's not random. It's not nightmarish. It's not Kafkaesque. There is something to all this. And that promise is usually enough to get me up and going the next morning, no matter what's happened.
So even though it may seem random from our very limited perspective, it sounds like you continue to have faith that there's a higher perspective where it's not
there random. There is a meaning to it, even though I can't. I've lost a child in my own life. I've had people who've lost loved ones, and they'll say, "Why did this happen?" And my response is, "I don't know," and we're not going to know. But give yourself some distance. Give yourself 5 years, 10 years, 100 years. You know, and you'll begin perhaps to get the inklings of an answer. I call them my picnic table questions. Should I get to go to heaven and have a conversation with Christ? I have a whole list of questions that I intend to have. I have no idea if I'll understand the answers or if I'll even be able to get that kind of time, but I live in hope, so I keep my list going.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. And we're speaking when we talk about the randomness of the universe and the meaning, and there's also people are now looking at quantum physics and saying that so many aspects of quantum physics now prove a lot of the things that spiritual people have been believing for so many centuries. And so I'm wondering, in your view, how does our understanding of quantum physics contribute to our understanding of spirituality? And what do you think is accurate and what isn't?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. One of the things that happens in science is that people always go back and revisit the basic assumptions again and again. Because if you're going to find some new wonderful avenue to pursue, you have to go all the way back and usually question something like, okay, what if parallel lines do meet? Then what happens? Or what if parallel lines don't ever meet, but they get further apart? Then what happens? The thing is, when you do that and you start to come up with a different way of talking about what you experience in reality, a different scientific model, one of the requirements of your model is it has to be at least as accurate talking about the stuff that the old models used to be able to talk accurately about. You can't just simply say, well, I've come up with this wonderful model, but it only works for this tiny little regime of reality, and we just ignore the rest of the regime, because that doesn't really satisfy. One of the things that happened when quantum physics was being sort of uncovered or developed was people were learning that at the very smallest level, the old models didn't work, and kind of in a similar way that they didn't work at the very largest levels. Einstein asked questions about what happened as we got closer and closer to the speed of light, what happened as things got very, very massive in a very concentrated way, and what would reality be like? And he came up with these extraordinarily dense and complicated equations, the field equations that hardly anybody can solve, and a lot of them are still unsolved to this day. We can model them on a computer, but we can't actually write down a beautiful, elegant equation that makes sense of them. But one of the things that had to be required in Einstein's equations was, all right, if this is true at these great distances and for these great speeds and great masses, it all has to reduce to Newton's kind of expression, the very simple, very elegant things that work really well here on Earth. You know, the fact that we can build buildings and we can have cars and the fact that we can shoot rockets into the sky and have them get to the moon or to Mars or to Neptune, all is pretty much a function of Newtonian physics, which works really, really well. The thing about gravitational theories is they reduce in the small distances and the small masses to Newton's equations. They're very hard to solve, so we don't even worry about them. We just use Newton, and kind of the art of science is to know when you use which, but you're sure that one goes to the other. Quantum physics is kind of a radically different beast because it has a totally different way of expressing reality. There isn't a sense of permanence. There isn't a sense of an objective reality that can be repeated. I can pretty much depend that if I walk into my room, the keys are where I left them. When my keys are not where I think they are, it doesn't mean that they've quantum teleported to another person's house.
Are you sure? Sometimes it feels that way.
It does feel that way, but I tell you, we cannot blame the universe for the fact that we've gotten absent-minded. They're just where you put them last. You've just forgotten where you put them last. They don't just move. They don't. And you know, we have entire insurance companies based on this, and we have prisons full of people who would love to be able to say, I don't know how that vase got into my possession. It just teleported into the trunk of my car. But it doesn't. And you know, we stake people's lives on this. And we stake our lives on this fact that our houses are where we left them. When we walk in, they have the same they were unless someone's been in the house and ransacked the house. At the smallest level, if you walk up to an atom with an electron and you turn your back and you look back and the electron's gone, that's just how it works on the smallest level. That reality is very permeable and things wink in and wink out of existence and you borrow existence from the universe for a short period of time and then you give it back and virtual particles abound and there are just clouds of extraordinary potential everywhere. The problem has been for the longest time with quantum physics is why isn't it that way at our scale? Because it's radically different in the way it treats things. From the spiritual perspective and from a person who comes at it from a religious background, I would love to be able to say, oh, of course, these are how miracles occur. We think in terms of determinism and objective reality, and therefore you can't simply have a person rise from the dead. You can't simply have bread appear out of nowhere. You can't have the kinds of miracles that people claim happen on a regular basis. But it's just a quantum thing. It's something jumping in from a different part of reality. But that doesn't happen in any sort of regular way. And there are too many miracles, frankly, for it to be able to happen in a mathematical way. If I was going to use quantum physics responsibly, I would say, yes, once in the lifetime of the universe, a miracle would occur. But it's only once, and it wouldn't be as often as we report them. And this is a fundamental question. There's just the beginnings of an answer. A team of scientists just before Christmas published a wonderful paper in Science Magazine. It's a very important paper that argues that there's a basic length scale in quantum physics having to do with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that says that quantum effects are necessarily going to be limited to the small scale, and they just don't grow to the regime that you and I live in as conscious human beings. As much as we'd love for them to do that, as poetic as that would be, it doesn't happen. And wishing it did or dreaming it did isn't going to change the reality of it. It's kind of modeling a transitions happen, I think, in broader philosophy. We went from kind of an objectivist view or a positivist view of reality in philosophy to a much more subjectivist view or a relativist view at the turn of the 20th century. And, you know, Einstein and the quantum physicists who were working in a different field at the time were all influenced highly by these philosophical strains that there is no fundamental reality. We create our own reality. We create our own experience. And we layer meaning that we supply on top of things. And, you know, it's a very postmodern way of looking at things. And it's true to an extent, but it has a limitation. And it's simply in a practical, pragmatic way, it has a limitation, or else, you know, commerce and financial things and pig belly futures and all those other things that make up our everyday mundane universe simply wouldn't work. It looks like what's happening is there is these sort of large islands of reality that are objective, but where interesting things begin to happen are at the boundaries between things. You know, think of it as the land and the sea. The sea pretty much keeps to its briny depths, and the land keeps to its rocky fastness. But along the beaches, during a storm, sometimes the sea and the land interact in extraordinary, fascinating ways, and there's entire ecosystems that have evolved to live in that sort of region of transition between water and earth. And I think that's probably how it works in physics, that we can speak pretty objectively about some scales, and we can speak subjectively about other scales, and there's some really interesting phenomenon that we're going to find happen at the boundaries between the two. And I expect that's true in spirituality as well. There are some objective truths about what it is to be human, some senses of what is good and senses of what is evil, that are pretty much universally shared by all. And there are parts of our experience as human beings that are much more subjective and layered on by our own history and our own filters as we experience the world around us, we experience the joy and love of meeting one another. And the fascinating part is the boundary between our subjective experience of reality and the objective nature of reality. And I think that's that permeability and that liminality is really the place I've been focused in my own attention lately. It's the place of becoming. It's the place of potential. It's the place of boundary. I find on a spiritual level that's the kind of thing that just makes me stop and have a good long ponder.
Well, I'm curious. We're talking about objective and subjective reality, and I think that a lot of people would label science as the objective and spirituality as the subjective. And since way back when, Galileo, Darwinian times, there has been a really strong divide between science and religion. And I've heard that you refer to science and religion as entangled states. So can you describe a little bit more closely what you mean about that?
You know, actually, I have a blog. It's www.entangledstates.org. The name Entangled States is this wonderful sort of image, and it speaks to what I was just describing, this sort of interesting boundary between two regimes of reality. But I used the title because at the time I was trying to speak to religious people who were pretty sure they knew exactly what was what and how things were supposed to be so. And quantum entanglement is a macroscopically observed phenomenon. It's fundamental to the workings of quantum computing, and it apparently is what underlies the act of photosynthesis in biology. That can't be explained at all in terms of classical physics, in terms of a binary worldview. Something is either yes or no. It can't be either one or the. It can't be both. It has to be yes or no. And I was arguing at the time to theologians that if we're going to take spirituality seriously, we have to allow ourselves to be informed by the world around us, and we cannot buy into an Enlightenment or a modernist worldview, which came from the time of Galileo, came from the time, really, of Newton, that argued that there is, you know, this or that, yes or no, that sometimes things are maybe, or even more complicated than that. And so I called it Entangled States, and I don't know that I ever convinced anyone particularly about it because I find it so difficult to explain. But there you have it. And as I've thought more about the metaphor of entanglement, and I've thought more about the idea of things being inextricably bound up with each other, I have found it to be a lovely kind of metaphor for how I understand science and religion. In quantum entanglement, you get this idea, in short, and you have to see me here, I'm holding my two fingers and I'm pointing them both up, and I'm imagining that they're both electrons that are spin up, and so they're both pointing up at the same time. If the two electrons are entangled in a quantum way, the moment I flip the one electron down, the other electron has to immediately flip down. Now, by immediately, I mean mathematically immediately, not after a delay accounting for the speed of light, which is what we would normally think of as the time it would take for information to propagate. This is one of the reasons you can't explain this in a classical physics way. It has to happen instantaneously. So I can flip one and the other flips. They become a pair that one change to one instantly affects the other. And that idea of science and religion, I think, as entangled, leads me to imagine that for people who do spiritual things, who think about theology, who think about religion, to ignore the reality of scientific thought is a horrible mistake and effectively puts them into a spiritual ghetto. Let me give you an example. Scientists pretty much universally agree that evolution is how biological life forms become diverse. You know, the mechanics of it are still sort of being worked out, but we see evolution in action in front of us, and you cannot deny it. But if you believe that evolution is how the life forms got their diversity, then you have to go back and reread Genesis with a different set of lenses in the Hebrew Scriptures, because the Genesis stories, if you read them in a sort of literal, infallible way, say that, no, it happened this way, this way, this way, this way, this way. And you end up with this idea that dinosaurs were wiped out by Noah's flood. Well, what ends up happening is you create the creation museums that you see springing up around the country. You see the Noah's Ark theme park where, you know, Noah is pushing the dinosaurs away and not letting them come on the ark. You create kind of a religious ghetto where you will not deal with the best science and the best minds of the world because they challenge your worldview in a way that makes you very uncomfortable. And so you separate yourselves from them. Everything I understand about humanity, everything I understand and believe about reality is that we are not meant to live in ghettos. We are not meant to live separate lives. We're meant to be bound up and interacting with one another. And I think the same critique that holds for religion also holds for science. Because, as I said, my own experience of realizing that I was making no difference in the world by simply writing out equations on a long piece of paper and imagining what happened to certain equations inside a black hole. But that by giving a child a sandwich, giving a child a cookie, I was making a difference in a very real and tangible way. And that was being motivated by my sense of wanting to do good. Well, good is not something I can write an equation for. Good is one of those intangible, subjective realities that I experience in religion and in spirituality and in theology. It's a concept that I know when I see it, and I know the lack of when I perceive that, but I'm not quite sure how I know it or why it should speak to me that way. Scientists who live in a ghetto where they deny the existence of good or evil, where they pretend that there is no great morality that has to govern their works, are the sorts that start doing experimentations on human beings, that start finding ways to do mass exterminations of human beings. You know, the idea that humans are simply there for me to manipulate and control, as opposed to cherish and learn from, is a very dangerous place. And putting science in that ghetto kills the soul at least as quickly as trying to put religion in its own anti-scientific ghetto. Mm-hmm. I think the idea of entanglement reminds us that the two are inextricably bound with one another. And without each other, they're both going to wither and die. And I hope it's just by the fact that I used to teach physics dressed in my clericals and my collar and my black shirt and my black pants. My students, while I wouldn't talk to them about religion, would at least get the idea that you don't have to say, I don't believe in religion because I believe in science. That there was some kind of middle ground that they could come to. And for some of them, I think it did happen. It's actually how I started blogging. They were asking me questions about that, and I didn't feel comfortable answering those kinds of questions in the classroom because it was an astronomy class, and it wasn't to talk about theology and philosophy. It was to talk about, you know, Hertzsprung-Russell diagrams and main sequence stars and luminosity equations. So I found blogging, oh gosh, it's almost 10 years ago now, fact, it is 10 years ago now, I found blogging as a way for me to be able to communicate these ideas to the students. And then I just kind of got bitten by the bug, and I've been writing and noodling about things for a long time since.
So it sounds like, Dean Nisley, you're saying that both science and religion need to accept
their dependence on each other.
Exactly. And because with religion, if you are all about religion and don't take science into account, essentially you're living a state of ignorance. And
well, if you live a religious life and you are coming to conclusions in your religious life that are simply not true in terms of objective reality, you know,
mm-hmm.
people, the human sexuality seems to be the great conundrum for us at the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st.
Mm-hmm.
And this argument that, no, we have to recognize that God made people male and female, and there's a sort of a biological necessity for why men and women should be the only allowed possible pairing. Well, but it ignores the latest science that we have from biology that says, gosh, there are people who are born with both sets of genitals. There are people who are born with gender that's kind of on a spectrum and not in one bucket or in another bucket. And if I have a religion that's going to say, no, I'm just going to ignore all that science. I'm going to put my fingers in my ear and go, la, 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 because it challenges something I want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put myself in that kind of religious ghetto, and I'm going to end up destroying people's lives, as well as not actually following the truth that I claim I'm seeking.
Well, Dean Nisley, I'm curious, where do you think that this idea came from? Because certainly in this modern age, we're seeing a lot more scientific evidence of homosexuality being fairly normal in nature, and of course people being born with both sex organs or gender identity disorders and things like that. But even at the time when the Bible was written, there must have been homosexuality or it wouldn't have been even mentioned. So where do you think this...
Well, it's actually not very much mentioned, at least not in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, this idea of Lot and Sodom, but that, honestly, if you read it carefully, is more about hospitality law and about humiliation of people than it is about any sense of cherishing and loving that you would see in a committed gay relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something in Deuteronomy or Leviticus, I can't remember the passage off the top of my head, about men should not act like women with other men or something
mm-hmm.
like that. But we're really not all that sure what that means. But there is some evidence of it, but it's not very much. And certainly in the ancient world, it was a known thing outside of the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. You find in other religious traditions, there's certainly plenty of mention of that. Within native cultures and aboriginal religions, it's kind of a recognized thing. Part of it may be part of the reason you have the kind of strict prohibitions you do within Christian and Hebrew traditions is that there's a binary worldview in the Old Testament. This idea that things have to be one or the other. You do the will of God or you do not do the will of God. And it's not till the New Testament, at least for us as Christians, that we see a different way of understanding God's will and recognize that human beings had completely misunderstood what was going on. And it's only in retrospect, viewed through the self-sacrificial love of Christ, that we can begin to make sense of things. As a Christian, I take a great lesson from that recognition that all the prophecies and all the promises of who the Messiah was going to be turned out to be right, but not in the way anybody expected. So that when the Messiah showed up, very, very few people recognized what was going on. And I think for those of us in religion who think we have it all worked out, we may have very carefully worked out something and taken ourselves way off the wrong street and have to find our way back to the center again.
Mm-hmm. And so as far as so many churches still, even in this day and age, rejecting same-sex couples, calling them sinners and all of that. I understand that the Episcopal Cathedral in Arizona has a more open view and is accepting of all types of people. But these other religions, why do you think it is? I understand they're pushing away the science, but what about the whole aspect of religion being about love and being about caring for your fellow man and treating your neighbor the way you would like to be treated? Why do you think there's such a strong separation between that ideal and this focusing on the same-sex relationships?
Well, I think the answer to that goes back to my present favorite theologian is a French literary critic named René Girard, who was recently a professor at Stanford and has just recently retired, started writing about anthropological literary analysis and ended up writing at length about Christian belief and Christian theology. He has this idea, and I'm pretty much convinced he's on the right track, if not having fully arrived, that human beings manage their conflict, their social conflict, by agreeing to blame a third party for the tension they feel between one another. I think a lot of the pressure we've had on gay and lesbian people in American society is a reflection of the fact that in a political way, gay rights functioned as an extraordinarily effective wedge issue, politically speaking, that could be exploited by social conservatives. The moral majority could use that as a tool to horrify people and get them to vote a particular political docket. And I think there was some real damage done, and frankly some cynicism. Look at our former vice president, Vice President Cheney, whose daughter is in a committed committed lesbian relationship. He certainly, on the campaign trail, was very much opposed to recognition and toleration of gay people in any official way in society. And yet his daughter works on his campaign, and he has never disavowed her. And great conflict came when social conservatives asked him why he could tolerate having a daughter who is actively partnered. And he just told them to back off. That was his daughter, and he loved her, and that was enough. I think looking at that just sort of in a sort of basic way tells you this had more to do with political expedience than it did with a deeply held belief on the part of the people who were flogging this as an issue in the American political stream. Mm-hmm. I'd like to tell you that religion functions outside of politics, but I think the two are strongly influenced by one another, and the political winds of the day influence the religious, and the religious ideas tend to influence the political. But in this country lately, I think it's the political influencing the religious more right now, which seems ironic, but I tell you, as a person who's in the middle of the religious world, I see a lot of opportunism on the part of religious leaders, seeing which way the political winds are shifting and rushing to get ahead of them, so that when the political wave sweeps over them, they're there, and part of the establishment and part of the movement. You know, we're Episcopalian, so why the cathedral here is different, and the Episcopal Church nationally is not of one mind. There's a strong majority of people in the Episcopal Church who believe that it's possible to be a gay or lesbian Christian and be in a committed relationship to another gay or lesbian Christian, but not all of us do. And that's true here within this cathedral. What we tend to have, for historical reasons, in the Episcopal Church, in the Anglican tradition, is a very strong desire of tolerance. And we just reorient ourselves. A lot of churches find their unity in a sort of clear specific way of reading the Bible. And there are other churches that find their unity in a clear set of conciliar documents, or churches that find their unity in a relationship to a great leader like the Pope. Anglicanism, at one level, really finds its unity in just being willing to pray with one another. And we leave an awful lot of things fuzzy. We get teased a lot, probably rightly so, for muddled thinking. But the downside of it, just I think from English church history, of seeing the civil wars that resulted when people would fight over what to us now seem totally obscure and pointless religious questions, tell us the horror of holding onto a belief too strongly and missing the larger picture. And so we just kind of, if you'll pray with me, I'll pray with you. And that kind of how we've worked it out. And it's kind of broadly diverse. But that's not just true for Episcopal churches. You see it in a lot of mainline denominations. You see it in a lot of faiths. I think people are coming to a sense of that. There's an old saying in Christianity that religion is something you should be willing to die for, but it's never something you should be willing to kill for. And I hope we would kind of come to a broad agreement about that in the world. It's going to require a lot of voices, though, standing up, because the issues we have in America on human sexuality and inclusion are just a pale shadow of some of the, you know, frightening and scary controversies in religion that are racking Islam right now, are racking parts of Christianity, that are racking Islam and Hinduism in the Kashmir regions of India and Pakistan.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, we've got to come to a recognition that this is not something we kill over.
Well, it almost seems like this whole debate about the same-sex relationships isn't so much about the actual issue. It's about just focusing on something and having something to fight about.
Yeah, pretty much it. It was about women's ordination in the middle of the 20th century. It's been about other things in the 19th century and the 18th century, and just go back in time. I'm leading a course here at the cathedral right now, a book by Philip Jenkins called The Jesus Wars, and it details how entire imperial armies would take the field against other city-states and kill off all the people because of an argument over the substance and nature of Christ. And we look at it and the arguments make no sense to us at all. And apparently it didn't make terribly good sense to the people at the time. They just knew that they were against those people over there, and they didn't believe the right way, so they needed to die. And it wasn't a fight over the reality. It was a fight, as you say, because we just wanted to fight. As Girard says, we deal with the tension in human relationships by finding a third party to blame.
Yeah.
Whether it's the Jews or the gays or the hippies or the Christians or the scientists, you just pick your third party.
The common enemy.
It's called scapegoating. And I mean, that's the mechanism and the term that Girard gives for it. And if you start paying attention to it, it's just extraordinary how frequently it appears. In Libya right now, Gaddafi is trying to find a way to reunify his country as the rebels are taking things and he's beginning to roll back and the world is looking on with horror. And he's internally blaming all the troubles on Al-Qaeda. So he's going to use Al-Qaeda as the scapegoat for what's happening in his country. According to Girard's thinking, the idea of scapegoating other people to find people to blame for our troubles so that we don't have to deal with our troubles is just hardwired into us. And it may be impossible for us to ever overcome. The only thing we can ever do is to reorient our desire away from what other people are doing or having or saying and towards good, towards that which is sacred and holy. And that has the effect of kind of fixing what it is to be human. But that's a whole other show.
All right. Well, speaking of all this fighting and the common enemy, before we close the show, I understand that there's a wonderful story from World War One that took place amid the fighting and the trenches, and it illustrates your understanding of the role of the church in the world. And so I'm wondering if you could conclude by sharing the story with us, please.
You know, it's a story I'm sure most people have heard. It's happened in the trenches on one Christmas Eve, very early on in the war. It's been written up, and there's been movies made about it. Basically, what happened is the British and the German soldiers were facing one another across no man's land, and it was Christmas Eve, and the British soldiers apparently heard the German soldiers singing Silent Night. And some of the English soldiers took up the song on their side of the trenches, and they began to sing the carol with one another. And eventually, one of the German soldiers, I think is how it went, got brave enough to lift a lit Christmas tree above the trench wall. And one thing led to another, and eventually on this Christmas Eve, the soldiers came out of their trenches and met in the middle, and for the next day or so, they shook hands, they played soccer, they shared cigarettes, they became a community. It terrified the officers. The officers eventually had to threaten with their pistols every single one of their men to force them from engaging with their enemy and seeing them as human and force them back into their trenches so that the day after they would pick up their guns and kill them and you know chew up more of the flower and youth of Europe in that awful trench warfare. A dear spiritual mentor of mine once preached a sermon, and he said to us, it was on a clergy retreat, that he thought the point of being the church is to sing Christmas carols in the middle of the great cultural wars of our day. And I think that's really influenced how I view the work of religion, the work of faith, is to be the people who stand up and in the midst of the war, in the midst of the hatred, in the midst of the conflict, sing Christmas carols, sing the songs that get us to look up towards the stars again, get us to look up towards the transcendent, towards the good, so that we can be taken out of the momentary violence of our day-to-day experience and begin to remember that the person that I think is my enemy can just as easily be my friend. And if that is all the church has managed to do, if that's all people of faith, people who are spiritual, manage to do in the world, that may just be enough. And that may be all we can ever hope to do, is to be the people who sing the carol in the darkest night of the war and ask people to remember that there is another way that they can live, and then let them work out how that's going to happen for themselves.
What a beautiful way to wrap up the show, and thank you so much for being on the show. And I understand that you are working on a book about entangled states. Are you ready to talk about that, or is that for a future episode?
It'd probably be for a future episode. The short version is we're taking a lot of the blog postings I've written over the years, some of the stories I just told you, and we're trying to put it together into a coherent narrative. And it's kind of my own musings on how science and religion shall be handmaidens, one with another. eventually we're going to get past that first chapter.
Well, I look
and once you get the first chapter written, the rest of it's easy. Getting that first chapter done. Exactly.
Beautiful. Well, I look forward to hearing more about it. And thank you so much, Dean Nicholas Nisley, for being on the show today. Is there anything you'd like to add before we close the show?
No, I wish everyone a joyous springtime, and for those that keep the holidays, a suitably spiritual Lent, and a happy Easter.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye.
Take care, Dean. Bye-bye. So again, that was Dean Nicholas Nisley. He is the Dean of Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Phoenix, Arizona. Thank you so much for being with us today. I would love to invite you to visit our website, namastepublishing.com, if you would like to find out more information about this show or to join in the spiritual community. It's absolutely free to join, namastepublishing.com. And if you enjoyed this show, please favorite the show, and that way you'll receive an email every week and you'll never miss an episode. Thank you so much and have a wonderful day. And I'd like to send out love to the people of Japan who are struggling so greatly right now. And I would just ask that all of our fears about what could happen for us and all of the earthquakes that are happening, I just ask that you would take that energy and transform it into love and healing energy for the people of Japan and as well as the people of Haiti who are still dealing with what happened there. So have a wonderful day, a wonderful week. Be well. Namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.